Hey friends, this is Matt Sewell, and you're listening to a very special episode 62 of the Popecast, the only podcast about popes where short histories of each pope of the Roman Catholic Church remind us that the world and the church's problems today are certainly nothing new. This episode of the Popecast is sponsored once again by our friends over at Catholic Balm Co., the very best in beard balms, oils, lotion bars, and tons more. I'm sure it's a little late to get your Christmas orders in, but then again, the Christmas season lasts until January 6th in this neck of the woods. So head on over to catholicbalm.co, catholicbalm.co, to check out all their great stuff. And be sure to enter the word Pope, P-O-P-E, at checkout, and you'll get 10% off your entire order. So once again, that's catholicbalm.co and the word Pope at checkout. Thanks again to Catholic Balm Co. for sponsoring the Popecast. Okay, this week on the Popecast, we have a very special guest joining us in Father Harrison Ayer. Am I pronouncing that right, by the way?
Ayer, like the air you breathe.
Ayer? Yeah. Ayer, air you breathe. Yeah. Great. Yeah, so he's a priest of the Diocese of Victoria, BC, pastor of St. Peter's in Nanaimo, doctoral candidate at Maryvale College. Maryvale College, not university.
Maryvale Institute. Right?
Institute? Oh, yes. Institute. Sorry.
Yes.
I did a quick Google search.
It's all good.
Showing my ignorance here. But,
it's a small place. Maryvale. It's a small place, but yeah.
Small but mighty. Very solid, I'm sure. And then most recently, co-author of the book Finding Christ in the Crisis, What the Pandemic Can Teach Us. So anybody who wants to check that out, there'll be a link in the show notes. And of course, an all-around great guy. I'm super grateful that he is on the Popecast here to nerd out on all things Pope Benedict, I hope. Father Harrison, thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me. This is great. Any time to nerd about Ratzinger, Pope Benedict, I'm very eager to do.
Oh, amen. Yeah, for sure. Okay. So, maybe to get us started. So, followers of anything that you've recorded on Clerically Speaking or read on Twitter know that you're, of course, a super fan of Joseph Ratzinger, aka the great Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI. So, this is a broad question, but how did that come to be the case? Your kind of love for Pope Benedict, your interest in his work and life, and what about him draws you to his life and thought?
Yeah, so I'm a revert to the faith, I guess you could say. Like, I was baptized as a baby, didn't really grow up going to church, and I had a conversion in university. And so about a year after my conversion, I really got into reading books. I wasn't a big book person beforehand. I remember one of the first real theological books I ever read was Ratzinger's Called to Communion on Episcopacy and the nature of the church, which was way over my head at the time. I maybe understood 25% of it when I first read it, but I found in his writing a depth and a real spirituality that underlines his thought that was really attractive to me. And so I started just reading a bit more of him and just finding out more stuff about him. And I'm like, oh, this guy's really cool. Then soon enough, so this is early 2005 when I'm starting to read him, and then he's elected Pope.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So it was so obviously you're paying attention to everything he's saying. You're reading, I remember when Deus Caritas S came out, I was working at our cathedral office and I printed it out on the photocopier right away and just ate it up that day. And I just loved it. So it was kind of by happenstance. I just kind of heard about him and I read this book and I kind of liked it. And it just kind of grew from there, really. He was kind of a guy who introduced me to a school of thought called communal theology, which he's very well associated with. And so it really opened my mind and my horizons to this great intellectual tradition that was developed in the 20th century of theology. So reading that and then listening to him as Pope, he had some really amazing homilies, speeches. I mean, I still haven't heard and read everything from his papacy because there's just so much always when you're a Pope. But everything I've read, I've just loved, right? And so that's where it kind of just grew organically and naturally. I remember writing a couple papers in seminary on him. And then, but then where it got really intensified actually was I was giving a seminar to the Missionaries of Charity, Mother Teresa Sisters in Gallup, New Mexico, which is where they kind of do all their formation. Mm-hmm. And you guys have some in Spokane.
We do, right? Actually. Yeah. Three blocks away from me, actually.
Oh, so yeah. I have to come down to Spokane then.
Yeah, but you definitely do. Yeah.
I would probably know some of the sisters there. I know most of the sisters in the Western Province now.
That's awesome.
Because I spent a year with them.
Okay, yeah,
I spent a year with them in seminary, so I know the sisters really well, and I love them. So I was getting, they said, so Sister Basilia Marie phones me. She goes, I want you to give a seminar to the sisters. Okay, what? What do you want me to talk on? Oh, you decide. I'm like, well, that's not helpful for someone with a brain like mine. We need to focus on something. And I said, well, I've been reading some really good stuff by Ratzinger lately. She goes, why don't you do a week-long seminar on Ratzinger? Which, and this actually, in some ways, the best place to start off with this stuff is with the Missionaries of Charity, because you can't, they want, if they're going to get theology, they want it to be theology. It's going to influence how they live charity in the world, but also how their encounter with God grows.
Right.
And so I was like, okay. So I wrote a bunch of talks. I had to do 3 talks a day for 5 days on Ratzinger. Wow. And I did it, and I loved it, and it was a lot of fun, and it really helped me even grow even deeper love. And then when I was, my bishop said, yes, you can go do your doctorate. The UK system is different than the American system, which is that when you apply for the doctoral program, you have to give your thesis proposal with your application. Which I wasn't expecting. Yeah. So like, right. Yeah, no, we would love to have you, but we need a thesis proposal to approve if we're going to accept you. And I'm like, okay, what am I going to do here? And I'm like, I've read a lot of Ratzinger in the last year. This will probably be a good place to go. So it's really kind of grown organically out of that. Now I'm just reading him all the time. And it's just, he's been, I think in some ways he's perhaps, I know John Paul II was an amazing teaching pope too. But there was something different about Ratzinger as a, because he was a professor through and through up until the papacy. Mm-hmm. And there was something in his talks and like apparently, from what I understand, his catechesis on Wednesdays had way more people than John Paul II's.
Yeah.
People love to listen to Pope Benedict. There was a depth, mm-hmm. but also an accessibility to him. Like, he can be very accessible, but you reread him over and over again, you're like, oh, wait, I noticed something I didn't see before, even though it's the same thing. Like, I've read the Regensburg Address like 12 times.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And every time I read it, there's something new.
Mm-hmm. That was the super controversial one, yeah. Right? Where everybody's like, oh, the Pope's bashing Islam, right? That was the one, but it's basically vastly misunderstood. Yeah. So that actually, that ties into the next question that I had. But, I mean, yeah, of what I've read from him, I mean, he's just like has this grandfatherly presence. And I almost am brought to tears, like, you know, a couple weeks ago when Pope Francis took the new cardinals to meet him. Mm-hmm. Just like seeing the two popes embrace and mm-hmm. Francis kissing his hand. Just like Benedict's just like this kind, joyful old man who, right, didn't want to be pope, was like, would just rather, what, retire and go read his books and play piano and hang out with his cats. And and that's great. It's just like this really gentle, heart. What was it? There was some line. I forget which book. I want to say it was like from, like Life and Testament, the second to last Peter Sewald, like book length interview with him.
Yeah.
Where he said something like, you know, what's heaven going to be like? And it was like walking in the garden with my father, something along those lines. It was just like this really simple, I don't know, just like this really beautiful imagery, like just holding his dad's hand, walking through his garden as a boy. Like, and that's what he envisions.
That ties in nicely with something he puts in the introduction of Jesus of Nazareth. This is my personal search for the face of the Lord. That's what it's all about for him. Mm-hmm. It's searching after the person of Jesus. And so for him, this real desire to find Jesus, this is what it's about. And so sometimes, you know, theology can get very academic, and he is dealing often with a lot of academic issues, but he's always trying to tie it in, like, into the person of Jesus. We could call it that he's very Christocentric, right? Mm-hmm. That he puts Christ at the center of everything. And if you want anything you want to understand in theology, Christ has to be at the center of it. But yeah, you're right. So like this idea, like this sharing, walking in the garden with the Father, or my personal search for the face of the Lord. Mm-hmm. There's a beautiful, like, simple piety there that you wouldn't expect of an academic almost, right? Right. And it's really, you're right. And it's like that grandfather character. I've always found him that way. Like, have you ever seen him in person?
No, sadly. No. The closest I probably got was like seeing him on TV as I'm walking through the Montana State Capitol in college as he was walking the streets of DC. That's
right.
The closest proximity I've been to a pope. But
I got to go to 2 World Youth Days with him, Cologne and then mm-hmm. Madrid. And the second one, especially in Madrid, I was really struck because I was a seminarian at the time, and so they had a special mass for seminarians and religious and stuff like that with him. And I was like 10 rows away. It was like so awesome. Oh, yeah.
Man.
It was so cool. Awesome. It was great. And I didn't understand a word because it's all in Spanish. But there was a simple, like, because all the seminarians were just like bursting with joy, obviously, right? And and there was a simple presence to him and a simple love. And he just, he's not a grandiose person, right? Even the way he celebrates liturgy, he really works hard to make himself almost invisible in service to the Lord. And that that great humility and that simple piety, I think, really embodies who he is as a person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's funny that the image that comes to mind when you say that is, was it, remember when it kind of made the rounds when people, like, you know, search back and he resigns 2013, and they're like, oh, the last one to do this was St. Celestine V in, I forget exactly what it was, 1413 or something like that. Celestine, right? I don't think we haven't covered him on the podcast, but we will, I'm sure, relatively soon. But he was, you know, 86-year-old man, something around there when he gets elected. And the only reason he got elected was because the cardinals were so split. It was like the French and the Spanish cardinals, something like that, were bickering for so long that, you know, Celestine's a monk in, you know, some hermitage a million miles away, writes a letter to them and say, would you guys get your crap together and elect somebody already? And the cardinals were like, okay, wise guy, we'll pick you. And so, you know, totters on to Rome. I think they were in Rome. I forget. I'm pretty sure they're in Rome by then. And then, you know, it's like the popes had to come in. Armies back then, all this stuff. He was woefully ill-equipped. I don't know that that's necessarily the case with Benedict. But Benedict goes and visits his tomb in, what, like 2009? So halfway through his papacy. The cathedral is under construction where that was. And everybody's like, why the heck is the pope stopping here? And he placed his mitre on the grave and then left.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay, that was weird. And then on to the next story.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden it's like, it has a significance. Cause like, you can imagine Celestine as he's like, okay, I quit. I'm not cut out for this job. I'm going to go back to my life as a hermit.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the same spirit. You almost get the sense.
And it's interesting because, I mean, he knows Rome like the back of his hand. He lived a very simple life. Like, there's so many amazing stories about the simplicity of life he lived even before he was pope. I mean, obviously, when you're pope, you can't go out wandering the streets like you once could. Not like John the 23rd did or something like that, you know? It's like...
Pope Francis did, I think, like 3 days ago. He snuck out to serve the poor. But yes, right.
Everyone's going to know you're there, especially nowadays in the media age. Everyone's got their phones, the pope's out, you know? Even if they try to go incognito, everyone will notice who you are, right? Mm. But like when he was the head of CDF, like he had this one little restaurant he just loved to go to, and that's where he went all the time. It was very simple. It was never ostentatious or anything, and he lived a very simple lifestyle. But he knew how the Roman machine worked, and he knew the bad players, and he worked really hard to distance himself from everyone. It a very beautiful story, actually, was. When Marcial Maciel was still with the Legion, they invited him to give a talk. And this is now, I don't have 100% proof of this, but I've heard it from enough good sources to think it true. He gave a talk, and after the talk, one of the higher ups in the Legion went up to say, oh, Father Maciel wanted to give this to you, thank you for your service. And it was an envelope full of a lot of cash. And he said, no, I do this for the good of the church. He refused the gift. He didn't care about money. He just wanted to live a very simple life. And it's really amazing. But to go from being the head of CDF, which is really, after Secretary of State, it's one of the most important, that and Congregation of Bishops. Those are your two most important positions in Rome. And he knew all this, and he gets to become Pope, and he knows the limits of his power. Even though he's got absolute, like, canonical power, I've heard stories multiple times. He says my power ends at the door.
You know? I've heard that too.
Yeah, you know, and this doesn't surprise me. And I think he knew he couldn't do what it took. And there's also health issues too. John Paul II revolutionized the papacy.
Right.
And you can't have World Youth Day without the Pope.
Right.
And he wasn't allowed to travel to Brazil. So there's, you know, it's tough, but it sets a precedent that I think is going to become more normal in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the idea of having three popes is just so intriguing. And I mean, it's going to, you know, set off a certain section of Catholic, quote unquote, Catholic Twitter, maybe we can call it. But yeah, we can leave that. But I mean, I was going to bring something else up that I completely just forgot. But yeah, anyways, that's so beautiful. And it does segue. We probably already have answered the second question. But one of the things that always frustrates me about, I mean, at least bums me out about a lot of the Catholics in the pews, you know, the people who are more or less disengaged, go to mass regularly, maybe, but aren't necessarily super engaged, like, you know, worldly Catholics, maybe in like the most charitable way possible to describe them that way. Mm-hmm. But they can kind of tend to give Benedict a bad rap. So, I mean, the peak of this to me is the perfect representation of this to me is the ridiculous characterization of him in The Two Popes. So I know we did a review and it was kind of off the cuff. I watched, the more that I think about it, the more I was like, this is just so ridiculous. I think they got Francis pretty right, but they got Benedict all wrong, right? It's like this guy who campaigned for Pope after John Paul's death, or that he's the polar opposite of Pope Francis, all of that type of thing. So why is that completely why are people who give him a bad rap for, you know, being retrograde or whatever, basically completely wrong?
It's so interesting, and it's so interesting that – so I actually haven't seen The Two Popes because – on purpose. I mean, I've read some good reviews of it. If you see it as fantasy, it could be a lot more entertaining and stuff. But I'm just like, I just love Benedict too much, and I know I am not gonna be able to watch it with an open heart. Because
I was just gonna say, from the little that we've just been talking, I can already tell that you would probably hate that. Because
So, but there's so the reason I think the main reason is. When he went to the CDF in the early 80s, he really, like, there was a mess after, and we're still kind of dealing with some of the messes after the council. It's not the council's fault. It's other things.
It's the Americans who implemented the council.
Americanism is a sin, you know. It's a heresy, as we know. It's, thank you, Pope Leo XIII. Yeah, so that's why everyone has to become Canadian. This is the way it
works. Okay, this interview.
I mean, you're pretty much in Canada already.
I am practically there. You know, at this point, I might move to Victoria and just pretend that Washington doesn't exist.
Exactly. That's what's he really worked hard to draw some boundaries around theology again, because it kind of went a little off the rails after the council. There was a real... and so he did a lot of work on things like liberation theology, how we understand the church, because the nature of the church was really getting politicized by the phrase people of God, by a kind of Marxist ideology that he found disturbing, because people mean something vastly different in the Old Testament than it does. But people read the word people and they kind of presumed a Marxist interpretation when it's really an Israelite interpretation, essentially. So he worked really hard on stuff like that. 2000 is perhaps one of his most fundamental documents, Dominus Jesus, on the universal significance and unicity of the person of the about the uniqueness of the person of Jesus and his saving mission. And that was a really important document, but it says stuff like, there is only one path to salvation, Jesus Christ. And to be a church, you have to have bishops in the Eucharist. Otherwise, you're in ecclesial communion. But he also has some really, like, and so people would go after him for all sorts of these things because he's drawing lines. And people, you know, we don't like the idea of lines being drawn because it means then we're not inclusive anymore. Mm-hmm. But I find it so frustrating for two reasons. One is when you read his stuff, he does his best to read everything in the most positive and charitable light. Mm-hmm. Like, if you ever read his debate with Casper in the early 2000s around the relationship between the universal and particular church, Ratzinger comes off the better person in that one. Honestly, Casper was a little too to the throat. While Ratzinger is just like, no, Casper's right in this and this. And he's not wrong in a lot of things he's saying, but this is why this is a more important thing without destroying anything he's saying. And so there's a real charity to say, I don't want to destroy the good that's there, which is a very Catholic way of doing theology. And same with liberation theology. He wasn't saying all liberation theology is bad, but he's saying we have to be careful by allowing certain Marxist ideologies to be the lens by which we understand the gospel. And when he talks about like the natures of the church, he actually has a, he says the church, the Church of Christ most perfectly subsists in the Roman Catholic Church. But then he says anyone who's baptized is a part of Christ's church, which is actually a very profound thing, because that means, that's why, yeah, really truly Protestants are brothers and sisters in Christ. They're part of the church in imperfect, like not the Roman church, but they're part of Christ's church. They're not in it fully. They're missing a lot of things, but the, but they're part of Christ's church by virtue of their baptism. That's a very charitable thing, actually. And so I really get frustrated by a lot of this, because I'm like, people actually haven't read him. He's always looking at things with the lens of charity, and he's always trying to give people the benefit of the doubt. And maybe sometimes that's a little naive in a world where there's people where things are cutthroat, and perhaps he, I don't know, maybe he was a little too trusting of people sometimes. But in the end, like he really tried to live the gospel and how he did theology and how he did. But in the end, in a world that doesn't like certain truth, he's going to come out as a bad guy, because he says, no, there are certain truths we have to hold as universal and true and can never change.
Right. Yeah. Well, I guess there's the assumption that, you know, John Paul was this, you know, electric figure who had been there for a quarter century and everybody knew him. And then, oh, here's this, you know, I remember it was a priest where I went to grad school down in Flagstaff told me that he was with a group of, I think, you know, the more, well, let's just say like a group of nuns who were not on the same theological side as Pope Benedict, maybe would be a good way to put it. Right. And he was, they were in the group that he was, who was watching the conclave. And I think he was a seminarian at the time. And, when they announced that Pope Benedict got elected, they were all like, no, can't be him. But yeah, it's just like, he gets a bad rap because of like the way that he looked, and they assumed that he was just kind of like the stopgap Pope, but then also for all the reasons that you said. But then it's interesting, and I remember what I was going to say before.
Yeah.
I think a reason why I don't read, you know, Francis's supposed missteps as all that bad, or like especially that John Paul II is complicit in the sex abuse crisis or all that sort of thing, I think of like what I know about my own parish, let alone my own diocese, which is very small in comparison to lots of other dioceses, and how bureaucratic they can be, and like how many places in the Swiss cheese there are to hide if you really have an axe to grind against somebody.
Oh, yes.
And then multiply that by a billion. And then you have the Vatican, right? There's all sorts of places that rats can hide in the Vatican. And so like, I mean, you know, Benedict knew just as well that like my authority lies outside the door, or lies right at the threshold of the door or whatever. There's some truth to that because there's all these people who are pulling the levers. The same with John Paul, the same with Francis, I think, because like, you know, anyways, that's a topic for another time. And I would love to chat about that with you, because I'm sure you have some really good things to say about it. But yeah, I really like that. And I think that's really good, just to like pay attention just to kind of the person that he is. And I also love that I just read Spirit of the Liturgy. I want to say it was like it was a quarantine read, I think, April, May, somewhere around there. And I was really surprised at how fast I read it and how good and accessible it was, because you think of something like the liturgy, and if you're, you know, a person who grew up with a priest in a small town like I did, where it was guitar masses, you didn't know any better that there was anything really good about that, and everything else was kind of foreign, and the people you asked about the traditional Latin mass all, you know, frowned about it and said, oh, you know, the stodgy old days or whatever. And then you see a guy like Benedict who's kind of who was supposed to be advocating for stuff like that, and you think you're going to be turned off by it or it's going to be inaccessible, but then he has this beautiful way of drawing out really simple concepts, the really simple, breaking down in a really simple way the importance of sound liturgy as just one example to like speak to a sound faith. It's just like, you can't have theology and not focus on the person of Christ. You can't have the Catholic Church without priests,
right?
As set apart, right?
Right.
But I think that's I think that's really beautiful about Benedict.
And he, you know, it's interesting what you say, because like this is another example of his pastoral style. It's interesting for a man who really had only like 2 years, I think, of parish experience. He really has a good pastoral sense. He said that after the council, reforms or so-called reforms really got hijacked, and they really got what's the word for? They just it got kind of bureaucratically imposed, right? It got really just in, from top down, no dialogue. There was nothing organic about it. And he said that was a problem and a mistake. And maybe even I think from what I understand, like I don't think even the council fathers kind of expected this either. But what he says, he goes, because what a lot of people want is they want the same response back. Now it's our turn to impose the liturgy and how we want it on you people. He says that never fixes anything. And that's also not how liturgy develops in the church. So if we want to bring things back on the right course, it has to happen slowly and organically. And that is very pastoral when you think about it, right? Even like if you read Spirit of Liturgy, like he talks about the beauty of Ad Orientem, but he says, listen, it might only be possible right now by just putting a crucifix on the altar, but that's we're orienting ourselves to the Lord in some way, and that's really important right now. That's a flexibility that a lot of people I don't think realize he has. And because this is the other interesting thing, especially when it comes to Catholic social teaching, him and Francis are like next to each other.
Right. Surprisingly close.
Read yeah. Caritas and Veritate, and people would be, I think, surprised how close Ratzinger or Benedict and Francis are. He's not the conservative a lot of liberals think he is, and he's not but he's not because he's not liberal or conservative, he's a man of the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, amen. I know that we had that, yeah, and I had that one on there too, because that's another one of those pet peeves where like we're like, oh yeah, Francis, you know, he's coming in, he's gonna change things, yeah. And he's progressive and all this stuff. I remember it was in the National Catholic Register about 2 or 3 months after Francis had gotten elected, and you know, like all of mm-hmm. the stories in the mainstream media were all about that. Mm-hmm. And it was, the title of it was 10 quotes to prove that the Pope's a liberal. And it was like, you know, there was like environmental and being sensitive to people with same sex attraction and like all of those things. Mm-hmm. And at the bottom, they're like, oh shoot, we forgot to say all of these quotes are from Benedict. It was like all those things. And like, I remember reading it. It was like, you got me. That's good.
Yep.
You got me.
Yep.
John Paul even too. And like how many more of the popes preceding them because they're men of the church, like people try to pigeonhole them based on style, but you just can't.
Yeah, you can't. And this is the thing. Every pope's going to be different. No pope is going to be able to be all things to all people all the time. I know we're talking about Benedict, but, I know some people struggle with Francis for a variety of reasons, but I think of things like, I'll give you one example that I thought, man, there's something to his method. Our BC health officer, when the Pope wrote that op-ed in the New York Times, I didn't read it, but our health officer at one of her press conferences about COVID was quoting and talking about Pope Francis's words, and she listened, and I'm like, holy smokes. And now this is being heard by tens of thousands of British Columbians all at once. Mm-hmm. That's something, right? And we need to remember, like, we need to reach out to really and truly all people. And so sometimes a pope is going to be able to speak to someone, to people of all political persuasions and stuff like this. But no pope is going to be for all things for all people. Benedict was not all things for all people because some people don't want the deep theological stuff or the really strong catechesis, or even they may not care about liturgy or whatever. That's okay. John Paul II, they all give us something different. They're going to lack some things, but in the end, like the church is one body with many voices, and there's many different ways to do things in the church with the heart of the church. And so we need to like be careful about seeing which pope does what. It's like, it's okay if Francis, actually it's a good thing, because if every pope's the same, we're gonna get bored with them.
Right. Yeah, I almost wonder sometimes, I mean, for goodness sake, I run a podcast about popes and why they're important and why, you know, mm-hmm. we need to not panic because history's been here before and like all this mm-hmm. stuff, but at the same time I wonder if the world, like the way that media has developed so that the pope can basically be like our second pastor, which is certainly not a bad thing, because there's so much goodness. Like the, mm-hmm. I mean, gosh, The Letter on Saint Joseph. Have you read that yet?
I haven't read it yet. I need to.
It's super short. Shameless plug. We did an audio version for people who don't want to read it and would rather listen to it. But
okay, cool. I'll download that.
But I mean, it's just like there's so much goodness there. But I almost wonder if it just takes the focus off of the here and now and allows us to be. It's similar to, I mean, U.S. politics. I'm only going to mention that one time for a very short, you know. At the risk of, you know, blowing things up or whatever. But I mean, it's the same reason why it's not important. Like, we should be paying attention to our mayors and being, you know, integrated with our own, like, local, even city councilors, like, who are in charge of our neighborhoods, right? Very Chestertonian, I guess, in that sense. Where it's like,
it sounds like subsidiarity.
Goodness. What a concept. What a concept. But I mean, yeah, it's interesting. Joe Heschmeyer, who was my last guest a couple months ago, said that he had a good line. We've gotten used to having like a theologian in chief with John Paul and Benedict, a philosopher in chief and a theologian in chief. And now with Francis, we're not really sure what to do because he's reminding us to do that to like be local and to be pastoral. Yeah. Like anytime he talks, he's talking to a person.
Yeah.
Like talking to a single person. Usually it's like and not necessarily to the whole church because that's the same reason. But go ahead.
I was going to say, and sometimes like he's talking to we are spoiled in the West. And we are not all the Catholic Church. And often he's speaking to a church that is poor, that is downtrodden and beaten, and those people need that word. And we're very narcissistic in the West, and we think everything is always about us. And it's
that is ridiculous. I'm an American. That is ridiculous. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you think about poverty. So, I mean, John Paul comes from a place where there was legitimate, you know, poverty of freedom, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, teaching us, like, we need to be able to have true liberty to be able to choose what's right, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And then Benedict, like you said, comes into, like, is in charge of the doctrinal arm of the whole church to bring us back, to put a fence around the playground on the precipice, right? Like Chesterton has that beautiful vision.
I love that vision, yeah.
Yeah, like you huddle in the center when there's no... If anybody hasn't read that, you got to go look it up. It's so good. Yeah. But he was... Like, we had a really profound, like, doctrinal poverty. Like, anybody who... People are fools if they think that, like, there wasn't actually a crisis or something like that, that the church is fine and then we can just do what we've been doing, right?
Yeah.
Where there was a real need for that. And now, because we're so arrogant in the West and because we're so fat and happy... In our nice warm houses, in our little subdivisions, and all that sort of thing, we don't have to talk to anybody else. Don't have front porches anymore. We have, you know, privacy fences that are 6 feet tall, so we can just stay in our own little bubble. Here comes Francis to challenge that, and I think that's so beautiful. It's like all of the popes are doing exactly the same thing, and teaching us to like go and be poor, like or acknowledge the poverty and seek it out. Mm-hmm. And the new evangelization accomplishes all of those things.
Exactly.
But yeah, I think that's beautiful why there's not actually any sort of discrepancy between the three.
And, you know, it's interesting. There's an interesting little article I found somewhere a while ago. It's a small article that Ratzinger wrote in like 1955 or something like that when he was just coming off of parish ministry. And I think a lot of the things he did, he recognized like everything he did in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Came from his experience of pastoral ministry in the late 40s and early 50s. And because he said that catechesis is in crisis and it's been in crisis for 40 years.
In the 50s. Man, yeah.
So, and we're still in it, to be honest. We really still haven't learned our lesson because we think... We think all again. How do we do catechism for kids? Here are the things you need to memorize about the truths of the church. Mm-hmm. Listen, that's not all wrong. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but we like in theology or philosophy to talk about this basic distinction between content and form. Like so, the truth of a thing, but also then how it's embodied, right? Mm-hmm. And so, it's like this idea of a parent bringing their kid to catechism class, but you know, not going to church on Sundays, not praying at home, and not serving the poor. Mm-hmm. There's no integration between truth and life. And so when you lose that, everything about what it means to be Catholic falls apart. And Ratzinger noticed this in the 50s.
Yeah.
I mean, that, which is unreal, right? And so I think a lot of his projects and a lot of his things actually come out of that brief pastoral experience of knowing what we need, or at least one area where we need to focus, right? And then, and Francis, like, in a way you could say, John Paul and Benedict brought us the content and Francis is bringing us the form, right? Yeah. And they really, there is a continuity there. Listen, again, there's probably some discontinuities, but it's like, also not every word the Pope says is magisterium anyways. So it's like, we can take a chill pill. But like when, even with Benedict, his interviews, they're not magisterium, and there were issues that people had with them. And I'm like, you know, so it's like, just, let's just chill and see the continuity and the good there, because I'm really convinced, like, you know, like, I think about stuff like lockdowns, for example. I mean, you know what? I actually said this in a homily a couple weeks ago when I was preaching about John the Baptist. We are non-essential because we've shown ourselves to be.
Mm-hmm.
We need to hear the judgment of God for this. And that's where Francis is great. But what Francis does is rooted in the goodness that John Paul and Benedict brought, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is a real common life between Francis and Benedict. I mean, if there was something really going wrong, Benedict is a man of conscience enough that he would say something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. So maybe, I mean, we've already kind of answered that a little bit, but I mean, there's, you know, most people who are, you know, most Catholics aren't going to be, you know, super in the know on Catholic Twitter, or like, aren't going to be reading those, like, deeper philosophical, theological treatises, all that sort of thing. They may never read any work of Benedict at all, but he's still important, right? I mean, you know, you and I would definitely agree to literally everyone. We've addressed kind of how Francis is, but how does Pope Benedict, I mean, whether it's his life, his writings, his papacy, affect the average person in the pews? And maybe, maybe a good way, because I love that his role in Vatican II, the Second Vatican Council, is, I think, maybe, not well enough known. Like, how he's influenced it as a young priest who wore a shirt and tie because wearing clerics was out of fashion, I guess, back then, maybe. But yeah, how does that, you know, why is he a figure worth paying attention to for the average Catholic?
So, yeah, there's a few things. One is, you're right, he was very influential. He was the paratus, so it's like a priest advisor at the council to the Cardinal Archbishop of Cologne, Cardinal Frings. And and actually, he got invited because he wrote a paper on the understanding of Revelation. And Frings loved it so much that he got him to actually, like, write a few speeches for him. And the people loved what Frings said. So Frings is like, you're coming with me to the council. I need you. And awesome. So now I'm just trying to make sure I remember this stuff right, because this is stuff I still need to, like, work out a bit. He was very, Dave Verboom was heavily influenced by him. It comes from his study of Bonaventure and his habilitation thesis. But then he was also influential in Lumen Gentium and working on that one. And that came from his doctoral thesis on the Church of God and the People of God in St. Augustine. And so his academic work really flowed into the council. Interestingly, after the council, like, there was a movement, and all the theologians were part of it. It's called the Concilium Movement, which was to help promote theologically the council. And it started to go off the rails. So I love this, because I'm just to be the fly on the wall, the restaurant where this happened in Rome. And I forget the name, but there is it. And I want to go there one day when I go to Rome again. Ratzinger, Dulubac, Balthazar, I think Bouye. Bouye, maybe, I don't think Congar, I think Congar wasn't a part of this group, but anyways, and a few others got together, weren't happy with the direction of Concilium, and so started the journal called Communio.
Right.
Which is, well, it's not like big in the massive world of theology. In Catholic theology, I still think it's one of the great standard bearers of Catholic journals to this day. So he's been very influential, and he's really important to be paying attention in that regard. But then there's two more things I think he's important to pay attention to. One is, and this is stuff that I think history is going to show over time. Where he's actually most influential is not as Pope. Right. It was head of the CDF. Because, again, today, a lot of stuff coming out of the CDF and out of Rome, bears his mark from the documents he wrote over those 25 years. He set the policy and doctrinal tone for most Roman decisions today because he had a hand in everything over 25 years.
Right. Including the catechism, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, signed off on it.
Right.
Right.
What was it? It was like Cardinal Schönborn, I think.
Yeah.
This is, and I'm going to butcher the story a little bit because it was like 7 years ago, maybe when I read about this, but people were kind of, you know, grouching about the catechism just as a document saying it's, you know, all of the same things that people who have an axe to grind with the church are saying, that it's, you know, outdated and it's, you know, perpetuating all these old, you know, dusty doctrines and stuff like that. Or, or is it that it was, I don't know, whatever it was, they were complaining about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And saying that John Paul II and Benedict were just, you know, bad guys, I guess. I don't know, something along those lines. But he just had this line. He's like, okay, yeah, I mean, I guess the two guys who basically wrote the catechism and, you know, are propping up our understanding of the doctrine of the church right now are, you know, not essential to the life of the church. Yeah, you just, you know, just go ahead and you believe that. You just, you know, run along now.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. What about him as a figure, like, you know, Catholic or not, like on the world stage? I mean, the phrase dictatorship or relativism is like coming back up now. Mm-hmm. I've, you know, seen it in a handful of places in like just the last week, I feel like. But as a lightning rod, like kind of as a figure point, like in history, like what will be his legacy 50 or 100 years from now in the world, not even necessarily just the church?
So before I answer that, I want to say one more thing about the previous question.
Oh, yeah.
Because while I think over his encyclicals are unique in the history of the church, the encyclical on faith, Lumen Fidei from Francis, was mostly written by Benedict. So faith, hope, and love. Three theological virtues, which he gets from Joseph Pieper, a big philosopher from the early 20th century who was a big fan of. But no pope has written on love before, right? This is, I know, which is crazy, right? No, but this is the thing. And I reread it a few weeks ago, actually. And it was, I'm like, this is an amazing document. But I kind of hope and I pray, this is a little personal thing. He did a series, and it's published by Ignatius Press now, called The School of Prayer.
Okay.
And it's his collection of catecheses on prayer. This is perhaps a little hyperbolic, but it is what the theology of the body is to John Paul II, the School of Prayer is to Benedict.
Interesting.
He does such a beautiful job in these catechesis, systematizing and exploring the height, depth, and breadth of prayer. So it's a book, I've read it 3 or 4 times, and it's a book I always recommend to people because I think in that book, more than anything else I've ever read from him, you see his heart in its deepest way. So that's where I think Catholics need to pay attention to him. And I think that right there is probably his most accessible thing for Catholics.
Okay. Yeah.
So, nice. And then, okay, in larger case of history, there are a few things I think that are at play there. One is he really worked hard around the idea of Europe and what it meant. He really believed in the West. He really did. The Regensburg speech is a sign of this. There was, I think, Regensburg level speech is a speech he gave in France in 2008 to the representatives of culture in a former Benedictine monastery. And he uses this, he always loved to do this. He loved to use the situation. Like, he has a homily for Easter Vigil where he reflects on the phrase, the work of bees, right? He just, that's his homily, right? Or on Holy Thursday, the whole homily is on the Eucharistic prayer. It says, on the day before he was to suffer, that is today, that's the one day of the year those words change a bit, that the Latin there is hodie. He preached his whole homily on that one word, right? Oh, that was the situation. Yeah. That was the theme. And so he loved doing this. So he used this monastery as a theme to say, what do monks have, do monks have anything to tell us about the West? And it was one of the most amazing speeches he ever gave. it's worth, yeah, look up 2008 Culture France, Benedict 16th. You'll find it. It'll be the first thing that pops up in Google. And because I think in this, he's actually trying to show, and I think this is his movement on a broader, beyond the scope of the church move, is it's the phrase of, it's Pascal, essentially, Pascal's wager, to live as if God exists.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that to be human is to seek after God. This is what the monks can teach us, he says. And this is like, but he really loved that phrase, to live as if God exists. Because for Pascal, for Blondel, who is a big philosopher from the late 19th and early 20th century, and for Ratzinger, this idea, if you live as if God exists, you're going to discover that he does exist, mm-hmm. right? And so he says the monks teach us this. And so I think his ability to kind of prod that question, that was one of his big things he tried to do on a broader scale, was that dialogue with culture. And he actually, like, he established the courtyard of the Gentiles in Rome, right? This idea of this place of, with Cardinal Ravasi, right? So this place of encounter of culture and theology and philosophy and all these things coming together to allow a dialogue and a discussion to have. So he really worked hard on that. And I think in that regard, in some ways, I think actually more and more today, I think that question, I don't think he intended it to be prophetic and as in like a future sense, but it's becoming more prophetic because I think more and more people would be open to that discussion today, this year, more than a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
When life is no longer comfortable, things are no longer secure and sure, maybe we need to seek after God. And so that idea is, I think, one of his most fundamental ones and is going to be one of the larger impacts if it can be kind of taken up by the church at large.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh man, that's a perfect place to put a bow on it. at least for non-patrons. Hey. Yeah. So, so new thing we're doing here at the podcast is, we're saving the last question for our guests, exclusively for our patrons. And, we just started, have you guys heard of Locals? Have you checked it out on Clerically Speaking? I know there's people who have an extra grand with Patreon, but Dave Rubin started it, locals.com. Okay. So it's like a Patreon alternative. Anyways, so patreon.com/thepopecast is where you can find this little bonus question with Father Harrison. But yeah, thank you, Father Harrison, for being on the show. For those who are going to
thank
stop
you
right now,
anytime I can talk about rats here, I'm just ecstatic.
Oh yeah, amen. We can cap it for now. Where can people find Father Harrison?
On Twitter at @frharrison. Clerically Speaking, the podcast. So anywhere you download your podcasts. And I often write for simplycatholic.com or in my book, Finding Christ in the Crisis. I think that's everywhere I can be found. Or if you're on Vancouver Island, at St. Peter's, where I'm pastor.
Nice. Perfect. I regrettably thought that Father Harrison would be busy in April of 2019 when I had like 2 days to kill in Victoria. So I will not be making that mistake again if I ever make it up there. But
when the borders reopen.
Right. Yes. Anyways, yeah. Yes. Well, thanks again, Father Harrison. This is
no
excellent
problem.
Well, that's a wrap on our last new episode before Christmas of 2020. If you've been enjoying the Popecast, we'd be grateful if you took a minute and left us a rating and a review over at iTunes, or if you simply shared a link to this or another episode to someone you know or on social media for those who might also enjoy the show. Every little bit helps, and we, of course, make sure to read out all reviews right here on future episodes. Also, lastly, a quick reminder, again, to join us for early access, bonus content, and sweet Popecast swag over at patreon.com/thepopecast. Or, as some have requested, if you'd still like to support our work here but would prefer to skip Patreon entirely, you can always find us on locals.com or on Venmo, both at thepopecast. So as we close out this episode, perhaps the last one of the infamous 2020, let us remember to pray for Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI in thanksgiving for a fruitful life in service to the Lord and his church. Until next time.